Hi, my name is Mandy Jackson Beverly, and I'm a bibliophile. Welcome to the bookshop. Thanks for listening to the Bookshop Podcast. I appreciate the notes I receive saying how much you enjoy the show. Creating a podcast is a lot of work. It takes hours to research guests, edit, produce, and market each episode. Many of you have contacted me wanting to financially support the work I do, so I've made it easy. To donate using PayPal, go to thebookshoppodcast.buzzsprout.com and click on the small blue heart at the top right of the homepage. You can also donate via Patreon. The link is on my website at www.mandyjacksonbeverly.com and click on the Bookshop Podcast. I love what I do, and I believe in keeping the magic of independent bookshops a reality and to support authors everywhere. Now, on with the show. The past few weeks, I've experienced a slowing down of sorts, and not one that I welcomed. I'm not one to sit around. Rather, I prefer to be busy, learning new skills, researching a topic or person, writing, cooking, anything but cleaning the house. But last week, my inspiration came to a sudden halt. This happens sporadically, and as much as I know this means I need to step back and relax, I always find this act difficult. The precursors to this experience include spilling things such as coffee and overfilling my protein drink and having it shoot out from the blender. This is followed by losing keys, socks, and the dreaded ebbing in and out of Wi-Fi. My antidote is to hike, garden, and move furniture around in the hope of tiring my body so I can sleep. But with sleep comes the arrival of vivid dreams, and dreams are where I find the answers to my unrest. I've learned to welcome nightmares, for within their horror lies the antidote. All I need to do is face them head on, become an empathic warrior. This time, my dreams led me to a story I've been working on since Mum died 5 years ago. So I picked it up, and instead of reading it, I recorded me reading the first chapter. When I listened to the recording, tears welled, and once again I longed to call Mum, to ask her questions I'd forgotten to ask her for advice, to hear her voice. While the physical and emotional pain of losing someone you love eases over time, the shadow of emptiness does not. I still go to call Mum on a Sunday evening and then wait for Dad to answer the call. But Dad died 28 years ago. There's no parent to answer my calls. Since recording the chapter, I've experienced a sense of ease, and I know this means I need to continue writing the story I left, even though it's painful to write. The trick for me is to step into my armor before writing, to lose the I and write from the she, to switch on the camera and film the journey from a distance, jotting down notes while reminiscing. It's a slow process, and cleaning up spilled drinks and searching for lost socks is a hell of a lot easier. Susanna Hermans is co-owner and manager of Oblong Books and Music in Rhinebeck and Millerton, New York, in the beautiful Hudson Valley. Hi, Susanna, and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
It's good to have you here. Susanna, Oblong Books and Music has two locations. What is the history, the when, how, and why of the two stores?
Oh, sure. So my dad actually founded our store in 1975 with a business partner. They started out in our little Millerton, New York, which to this day has a population of about 600 people, a very small town. And they started out in a store that was tiny, like 500 square feet, like super, super small. And they started out as a true book and record shop, very 1970s vibes. And then they grew the business, and over time they moved twice within the same block into the building that we now occupy in Millerton. And so we actually now have two buildings. The main part of the store is in an old, like 1800s department store building. So it's very like creaky wood floors and built-in bookcases. Nothing is level. it's pretty fun. And then we also have another building around the corner that we've connected. And that building is Oblong Junior, and it's all of our kids' books and toys. I sort of literally grew up in these stores as a small child. So that was a pretty great way to grow up. And then in 2001, so we're actually, this year is going to be our 20th anniversary. We opened our second location in Rhinebeck, New York, which is a little bit bigger of a town, but still a small town. Like the village has one traffic light. And that was, we had an opportunity that came before us. A woman had her dad had owned a car dealership. And after he passed away, she inherited the business. And she instead of running a car dealership, she wanted to turn it into retail spaces. So she created this incredible shopping plaza. So our bookstore is actually where you used to drive the cars in and they'd go up on the lift. but the cool thing about that was we were able to really design the store from scratch. We built everything custom to fit the space. We were able to, you know, pick our carpeting and like redesign everything. So it has a much newer bookstore vibe. So I always say that I have the best of both worlds because I have the old creaky bookstore and the new shiny bookstore, both.
Because you grew up within the bookstore, did you feel the draw early in your life to become a bookseller and part of the business?
My dad was very smart about how he raised me, because though I spent all of my time in the bookstore, he never once told me, this is what you're going to do. When you grow up, you're going to run the bookstore. He never said that. And he really let me find it myself. I did go off to study theater. I thought I wanted to be an actress. I still to this day love theater. It is my other passion beside books. But in college, I realized like, oh man, I don't want this to be my career. It's too hard. And I thought, what can I do? What do I know? What do I like to do? What do I know how to do? And I was like, oh, let me come home and run the bookstore. Help my dad run the bookstore for a minute. And of course, I fell deeply in love with the work because it's exactly what I love to do, connecting with people about books.
That was really clever of your dad.
Yes.
When I look at pictures of the Hudson Valley, oh my gosh, it's absolutely gorgeous. So can you please give us a description of Millerton and Rhinebeck for our listeners? That would be great.
Absolutely. So to give some perspective, we are about 100 miles or 2 hours drive due north of New York City. So we are within reach of New York City. We have the clientele / the demographic is a great chunk of locals and folks who've lived here a long time. This was and continues to be a strong farming community mixed with weekenders and folks who've relocated from the city. So we have kind of a fun mix that actually is really ideal for a bookstore because we have folks who are able to support our store who have disposable income for books. Our Rhinebeck store is closer to the Hudson River. So we get the tourism of the Hudson Valley River area. And then Millerton is right on the border with Connecticut. We're 1 mile from the Connecticut border. So we actually draw from Northwest Connecticut as well, which is kind of cool. So our stores are, they have slightly different demographics, but we, for the most part, sell the same kind of books to both.
And what about the geography? It looks so green.
It's very, green in the summer, for sure. Right now, there's a lot of snow. We just got a big snowstorm. So we've got about a foot and a half out there right now. But it's windy roads, lots of trees, hilly, not flat. Not flat, no. It's an absolutely stunning place to live. I feel like every year I become more appreciative of that. You know, we have all four seasons and all of them are beautiful, even the ugly ones.
A writer's paradise. Now, I see indie bookshops as a hub for communities, a place of comfort, healing, and joy. And during the pandemic, many communities have not only realized the importance of supporting their local indie bookshop, but all local businesses. Have you found this to be true for Oblong Books and Music?
Yes, I can't tell you how relieved I was to discover that happening, especially in the beginning when we first closed to the public. You know, it was such a shocking and destabilizing moment for everybody. But as a business owner and employer, all I could think about was taking care of my staff and keeping our business healthy and solvent. The amount of support, both financial and emotional support that we got from our customers and from our friends all over the country, all over the world, really, really blew me away. And it's sort of, you always have this like idea that you're doing good work and that you're important to your customers. But when you actually get the chance to see that, you know, really happening, it makes you feel good. It makes you feel like, oh, I am doing all this work for a reason, you know, someone notices that we're a good bookstore.
Yeah, I think the gratitude is a two-way street.
Yes.
And with so many children being homeschooled during the pandemic, have you seen a lot of sales in nonfiction children's books?
Yeah, it's amazing. I feel like even five, 10 years ago, I couldn't give kids nonfiction away. And now it's gangbusters, which is great because they've always been great books. they weren't glamorous until now. So I'm glad they're having a moment.
That's great to hear. You mentioned earlier that when your dad first opened the store, it was oblong books and music, meaning records. So what form of music do you sell now? Is it still records?
We've actually been a CD store, but lately, the last 20 years or whenever CDs came about. But, you know, obviously this is a smaller and smaller piece of our business. By no surprise, my dad still is very much a part of our store and he takes care of the music section. It's his like pet area of the store. And, you know, we have been downsizing it over the years and I'm sure we will continue to do so. But, you know, we're kind of the only place you can find CDs for sale, like between New York City and Albany, which is, you know, maybe like about a 200 mile span. So we do have folks who come from far and wide to browse because they know we're going to have stuff that they won't be able to find. So yeah, that's part of it. And we don't sell new LPs, but we do sell used LPs.
And how does Oblong Books and Music help support the community through outreach? And what is your affiliate program?
So anybody who has a blog or anything where you're linking to book purchasing can join our affiliate program and a percentage of our sales will be credited back to you quarterly. I don't have, off the top of my head, I don't remember the percentage, but I think it's a reasonable one. And we do so much with our community groups and I feel like we've done more this year than ever before. You know, whether it's, you know, we have a can on the counter where we're raising money for a local organization. We have donated large portions of our sales back to local groups. We actually just this last week were able to procure 10 signed copies of Joe Biden's memoir.
Wow, signed copies.
The signed copies. Yeah, we sold them at $100 a pop and all of the money, all $1,000 is going to the Grace Smith House, which helps women who are victims of domestic violence in our community. So anytime I have a chance to partner with a group, we jump at it because that's what it's all about, you know.
And that's another great reason to support your local businesses because quite often it goes unseen, but they do support the communities. And that's what I love about indie bookshops. Susanna, from the calendar on your website, it looks like you've kept an events program alive online during the pandemic. How is your attendance?
It's been good. So we have an amazing events team of two people, Helen and Leif, and they kick butt. You know, they really figured out how to pivot. You know, when we had to close down, we had previously been doing like over 100 events a year in person. And when all of a sudden the faucet just turned off on that, they let me have my freak out. And I was like, I can't do any events. I just don't book anything. And then finally, like Helen peeked her head back out in like May and was like, okay, how about now? Can I try to do this thing? And I was like, okay, you can try to do the thing. And I'll be gosh darn, but she totally figured it out. So now we do virtual events through Crowdcast. And I think we have anywhere between 5 to 10 a month lined up for the next few months. But they've been going well. I've been pleased. You know, I feel like we're getting more eyeballs on our authors than we would with physical in-store events, you know.
And have you seen an increase in selling more nonfiction or fiction of late? And what genre has been selling best during the pandemic?
Oh, gosh. I don't think I've really seen a specific shift in what our customers buy. They still tend to buy the same kinds of things that they did before. So fiction is still like literary fiction is still like our top category in the stores.
And are you affiliated with bookshop.org, IndieBound, or Libro.fm?
All of it. We do. Yeah. So on our website, when you look up a book, if it's available as a Libro audiobook, you'll be able to click right through to Libro and buy that audiobook. We are an IndieBound bookstore. And then Bookshop, we don't have our own page on Bookshop, like some stores do, but we are part of their bookstore pool. So we are, when people just buy through Bookshop, a portion of those proceeds do trickle back to us.
And in an interview with Kirkus, you spoke about wanting to see a more sustainable publishing and marketing industry. By sustainable, I'm guessing environmentally sustainable. What do you think can be done by indie bookshop owners to help with this issue?
That's something that I'm thinking more about these days, too, because I'm trying to think where some of the waste is happening. And one thing that I'm really pleased with this year in the pandemic times to discover is that by doing virtual events, I am able to order a quantity of books that fits my orders. You know what I mean? Like, instead of having to have a big pile on the table for the author to see that I might actually not sell that many of, I'm able to look and see how many orders I get for the book and order that many to fill. So there's less returns for events, which I think is really helpful for everybody in the pipeline. Nobody wants to ship a bunch of books to a store and get 95% of them back. Like, that's no fun. That said, we're still very focused on selling as many books as possible, but just not having to bring in that large quantity in advance is really helpful. But yeah, there's still stuff, we see issues with packaging and shipments of books and foolishly packed boxes, it's certainly getting better. I can say that, but we still have a little ways to go.
And what is one book you'd like to see more people reading?
Oh, that is such a good question. I thought I would pull up my little list of what I've been reading lately, because I was like, I bet she's going to ask me about what I'm reading. And I read a lot, obviously I read a lot, but I also like have such a revolving door of books that cross my eyeballs every day that if you ask me like, what am I reading? I'm going to have to refer to a document because I can't keep it in my head.
But this is one that you would like to see more people reading, not necessarily a book that you're reading right now.
So the one I would pick then is actually a book that just came out a couple weeks ago, and it's called You'll Never Believe What Happened to Lacey: Crazy Stories About Racism. It is by Amber Ruffin and Lacey Lamar. Amber is a comedy writer. She writes for Late Night with Seth Meyers, and she now has her own show on Peacock, her own late night show. She's the first Black woman to host a late night show on a major network's platform.
That's great news, and about time.
I know. It's bananas. It's bananas. She's hysterical. And she has a sister named Lacey who lives in Omaha, Nebraska, where they grew up. And this book is filled with stories that Lacey has told her over the years about just like crazy, super casual, racist stuff that happens to Lacey on a daily basis in her life as a Black woman. It's absolutely a must read for everybody. And it's you learn a lot, but it's also hilarious. So I would definitely recommend that.
And do you personally read more nonfiction or fiction? And is there a genre in particular that you like to read?
I read pretty widely. I do tend to read slightly more fiction and slightly more grown-up books. And within fiction, I am definitely a sucker for a good thriller. So that if I had to like, if there was a genre that I tend to read more than others, I guess I would say thrillers.
It's funny you should say that because at the beginning of the pandemic, like everyone, I kind of froze. And I've mentioned this before, but the books that I started reading that got me back into reading were the Agent Pendergast by Preston Child series. I think I read like 10 in a row. And I think it was just because it took me away from every day and I didn't have to think about too much. That's kind of what happened. But now I have my reading mojo back, so I'm kind of still reading their books, but a bit of everything.
Yeah, I read a lot during the pandemic. I know some people couldn't read at all, but I couldn't stop reading. Like any moment that I needed to get away from my life, from my brain, from my work. And I just poured books into my face. But what I found was when I, at the end of the year, I sort of look back and say, okay, what did I read? I read more books than I've ever read in a year, but I also had less favorite books. Yeah. I feel like I was just sort of like shoving books into my head without really appreciating them.
Well, here's to reading many more books. Susanna, thank you so much for being here today. I truly appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Take care. Bye.
If you're enjoying the Bookshop podcast, please consider becoming a patron. For more information, go to www.patreon.com/thebookshoppodcast. Or you can go to my website, mandyjacksonbeverly.com, click on the Bookshop podcast, and you'll find more information about me and the podcast there. From bookshop to author. Jody Millman is a lifelong resident of Poughkeepsie, New York, which serves as the setting for her legal suspense novels. In her writing, she draws upon her experiences as an attorney to capture the tensions that arise when a small community is rocked by tragedy. Jody's debut thriller novel, The Midnight Call, was released by Immortal Works Publishing in 2019. The Midnight Call won the 2020 Bronze Ippy Award, the 2020 American Fiction Award, was shortlisted for the 2019 Clue Award, and received the first place blue ribbon as Best Police Procedural by ShantiaViews.com. Hi, Jody, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Mandy. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. Jody, where did your love of thrillers come from?
Well, I'm going to tell you the truth. It's Nancy Drew. When I was about 10 years old, my father's first cousin gave me a huge box of Nancy Drew books. And actually, it was the complete set. So I was 10 years old. She gave it to me right before the summer. And I spent the entire summer reading the entire Nancy Drew set.
That must have been exciting.
Yeah, it was exciting. Yeah.
Do you remember how many books are in the complete Nancy Drew series?
Well, you know, I'm not sure whether they still write them. There was a person, the original author was Carolyn Keene. And then after she passed away, people took over and wrote them. So I can tell you that at least, I mean, when I was reading them when I was 10 years old, I mean, there had to be at least 30. I mean, I don't keep up with it, but I mean, it's one of those series that just goes on and on and on.
I love seeing children finding a series of books they enjoy reading and the excitement when they finally get to buy the next one or pick it up from the library. It's wonderful.
You know, and I'm going to tell you something about it. You know, it inspired me so much that I remember as a kid writing my own Nancy Drew. Do you know what I mean? Kind of copying it. And I think that was really my first introduction to wanting to be a writer.
And Jody, you have a background in law and literature, but you obviously have a love of theater and music. What drew you to create your podcast, Backstage with the Bardavan? How long has it been live? And what is the Bardavan?
Okay. Okay, well, the Bardavan is actually the Bardavan 1869 Opera House, formerly the Collingwood Opera House, which has been the stage for people like Mark Twain, the Barrymores. In the 40s, Frank Sinatra came there, Aretha Franklin, Tony Bennett. It's been one of these really amazing places in New York State history. And in fact, it's the longest operating venue in the country. I was talking to the man who's the executive director, Chris Silva, and we realized that there was no oral history of the people that had appeared at this facility. So what we decided to do was start this podcast where we would interview artists who had performed there and also would be performing there in the future. So it's really been kind of exciting. We started it, I would have to say, about 2 years ago, and we do about 12 podcasts a year. And surprisingly, it's very hard to nail down performing artists, because when they come to the Bardavon, they're usually doing the rehearsals. And I mean, we've had to hold our interviews everywhere from on stage, the orchestra pit, downstairs. I mean, it's been total chaos, but it's been absolutely wonderful.
And in the same vein, you are the author of Seats, New York, a Theater Guidebook, and Seats, Chicago. Emmy Award-winning actor James Earl Jones said of Seats, New York, and I quote, "For culture and sports lovers, Seats is the most practical gift imaginable. Now all of our friends know what they're getting for Christmas," end of quote. If I had the book in front of me and opened it, what would I see, and where did this idea spring from?
Well, first you would see seating charts for every single Broadway theater, off-Broadway, concert halls, and stadiums for the New York metropolitan area. Let's talk about that one. And I mean, you'd find not only seating charts, where to park, how to get there, the transportation, how to get free seats, how to get cheap seats. And I mean, it's really a concierge for anybody who truly is a lover of the theater in New York. The idea was actually the brainchild of my father, Sandy Millman, who published the first volume in 1998. And shortly after it came to publication, my father untimely passed away. So the publishing company came to me and they said, "Look, you know, we've got a book tour. Would you be interested in representing your father?" So I did, and I traveled, you know, the New York metropolitan area, talking to people, meeting people, and then they came to me and they said, "Hey, would you be interested in picking up the series?" So we did two more volumes, and then we did one in Chicago. And it's really been, it was a wonderful experience. I mean, actually visiting every single Broadway theater. Can you imagine that? Backstage tours. I mean, I met some absolutely incredible people, and people would come to me and they'd say, "Hey, we've looked at your charts and your charts are more accurate than what we have." Because a lot of their charts were prepared by Telecharge or Ticketmaster, and they really didn't have the three-dimensional quality. And we also had producers of shows contacting us to say, "Hey, we stage our show based upon the way that you've created these charts." So it was really a wonderful experience. It was a lot of fun.
And Jody, on your website is a page titled Writer's Law School, where you post articles you've written regarding legal tips for authors. What was it that impelled you to create this page?
Well, that's my specialty, I would have to say. From the time I went to law school, I attended a special program at NYU for my third year. At that time, they called it trade regulations, but today you'd call it intellectual property. So I was one of the first people, really, I think, in the country to participate in that program. And I was always interested in copyrights and trademarks and patents and licensing and the music industry. And so I thought, okay, now that I'm a writer, how can I help my peers? What can I do to give back? And so what I try to do is pick articles that they are actual tips. It's not esoteric. It's actually nuts and bolts articles about what writers can do to protect themselves.
Yeah, I was reading some of the articles you'd written and I got lost in the language and forgot what I was actually reading about. But the article I was referring to was relevant for authors during the pandemic. One of the words, force majeure. I mean, what a gorgeous word. And what is the meaning behind force majeure?
Well, force majeure really means act of God. When something happens that you absolutely have no control over. And clearly the pandemic is one of those situations. And that article addresses how writers, in fact, have been impacted, especially writers with contracts. The force majeure allows a publisher to postpone, sometimes indefinitely, the publication of a book based upon the circumstances in the world. And as we know, I mean, fortunately, there's the digital world, which has allowed authors to become published. But, you know, you're having shortages of newspaper or paper because and printing services because they're coming from Canada. I don't know if you've had to deal with Ingram Spark lately, but they are as slow as a turtle. And a lot of that has to do with the publication process. So, and I have many, many friends whose books have been delayed as a result of this force majeure clause.
And speaking of publishing and authors, can you tell us about your journey from manuscript to publisher?
That's a long and winding road, as the Beatles would say. I would have to say that I started the book in 2010, and maybe I finished it two or three years later, 2013. For years, I tried to obtain representation, and I attended a lot of conferences, and I was offered the opportunities to submit my book to several publishers, but I wanted to be represented by an agent. So I had previously met a woman named Loretta Barrett, who was really kind of like the grand dame of agents. She represented one of the popes, and she represented, you know, just many people. She'd been in the business for many years, and had said, you know, give me a call when you're ready, to be published. So I contacted her firm, and I learned, unfortunately, that Loretta had passed away. But one of her partners said, hey, look, you know, let me take a look at your book. And so I submitted it and I got a call. I'll never forget this. I woke up that morning. It was November 2015. It was one morning in November. And I said to my husband, you know, I cannot take this rejection anymore. I had so many rejections that I could wallpaper my bathroom with all the rejections. I said, I can't take it anymore. I'm going to go practice law. I just can't deal with this. That night, the phone rang. And it was a gal named Laura Van Warmer. And she said, I love your book. I want to represent you. I'm so excited for you. So Laura took me on as a client. Well, it was 2016 and Laura was on her way. It was in May to visit Betty White, who was another one of her clients, to celebrate Betty White's 94th birthday in California. But unfortunately, Laura never made it to the airport. She was in a head-on car crash. And it was terrible. I mean, she was hospitalized for months and months and months. And I guess woke up and realized that she really couldn't handle being an agent anymore. So the agency closed. There I am. It's 2016. I'm back where I started. I do not have an agent. I've got nothing. So I put the book on the back burner. I'm telling you, this is a long and winding road. Yeah, well, I put the book on the back burner and I said, you know what? I'm going to proceed ahead. And I started to write my second book because I perceived this as a series. And so it was in March of, I think, 2018, I entered a Twitter pitch contest. And for those of you who don't know, there's a group called pitchwars.org. And four times a year, they have Twitter pitch contests. And you pitch your, at that time, it was 144 characters out into the Twitterverse. And if you're lucky, people, you know, either an agent will contact you or a publishing company or nobody. Well, I couldn't believe it. I was contacted by this small publishing house in Utah called Immortal Works. And they said, you know, we like your concept. You know, let's see a couple chapters. So I sent them in. Okay, we want to see a couple more chapters. Sent it in. Let's see the whole book. I sent them the book. And I mean, I got this email. I'll never forget this. I was sitting in the Bardavon Theater at their annual gala. And I get this email. We're there to see Tom Jones. He's the guest for the evening. And he was really great, really sexy, however old he is.
It's his hips.
So I get this email and it says, we want to publish your manuscript. However, we have several changes we'd like you to make. If you're interested, let us know and submit them. So I said, you know what? I've really got nothing to lose because they wanted me to get rid of profanity and, you know, if there was graphic sex or violence, and I was writing about a murder. So there were some things that I really had to change and had to clean up. So it took me about 6 weeks, polished it, sent it off to them. Week later, I got a contract and the rest is history. So I'm telling you, you never know when lightning is going to strike. And I can't stress that to people. You can't give up. You just never, ever know.
Jody, never give up is my mantra. And kudos to you for sticking with it. That's a great publishing story.
My life is one big story, starting with Nancy Crew.
So now we're on to your novel, The Midnight Call. It won the 2020 Independent Publishers Book Award and the 2020 American Fiction Award for Suspense Thriller. In the book, attorney Jesse Martin finds herself in a bit of a pickle, to say the least. How did Jesse's character begin to percolate? And when did she become more than a thought and morph into a main character and a novel?
She became, or actually the underlying kernel of the story began, I'm going to go back to 1969. And I'm going back to 1969 because at that time I had a very charismatic history teacher that everybody loved. He was charming, he was interesting, but he was a little off. If you fast forward to 1979, after I graduated from law school, open up the Poughkeepsie Journal, and there's his picture on the cover indicating teacher held in connection with student's murder. So I'm thinking, okay, this guy was my teacher and he's a murderer. And it turns out I knew all the attorneys involved. I knew the family of the victim. I mean, there was a lot in this true crime that resonated with me. And in the back of my mind, it's one of those things that you say, you know, you can't make this stuff up. And so it resonated until 2010, when I decided to sit down, take the kernel of the story, which was a popular teacher who commits a random murder of a student, and I spun it. I created, I wanted my protagonist to be a female. I wanted her to be a female attorney, because that was something obviously I knew about. I wanted her to be pregnant, because I thought that really raised the stakes of this character. I wanted to give the readers a 360-degree view of a criminal procedure murder trial. And so I created Jesse, who's my main protagonist, but the story's also told from the perspective of Jeremy Kaplan, who is the criminal defense attorney who ultimately betrays Jesse, and Hal Samuels, who is an assistant district attorney who's also has a history with Jesse. So, you know, I'm not going to say that none of these characters are based upon any of the true life characters. It's just that tiny seedling of that murder, that senseless, useless murder that really prompted me to write this story.
And as an attorney, one has to unravel stories, the circumstances behind the why, who, where, and when, similar to that of a writer. Have you drawn on the psyche of clients, not only yours, but others you've studied, to give you an understanding of how the mind of a killer, or as in your book, an attorney in deep trouble, works?
That's an interesting question. What I can tell you is that through the practice of law, first of all, when someone walks into your office, you really have like 5 or 10 minutes to assess that person. You have to become really attuned to figuring out, is this person going to be a reliable witness? Is this person honorable? Is this person somebody that you can work for and work with, who will, excuse me, take your recommendations when you're making a suggestion in the course of their litigation or whatever matter you're representing them in? So I would have to say that, you know, being an attorney taught me to assess people. It taught me how to be a storyteller, because when you are an attorney, as you said, you have to convince a jury, you have to convince your adversary, you have to convince a judge, you have to convince the other attorney of your position. And that was one thing that really intrigued me about becoming an attorney, being an adversary, but at the same time being a storyteller, telling my client's story in a cogent fashion. It also helped me to develop my vocabulary, to develop pacing, to develop certain techniques that attorneys need and writers need that are similar. However, one thing about attorneys, we're never brief, and I use that term loosely. You know, we're never taught to be brief. And that's one of the pitfalls that I've had as a writer, like knowing what's necessary and what's not necessary to convey.
And you live in Poughkeepsie, New York, which appears beautiful, but it does have a dark side. The Poughkeepsie Killer comes to mind. Were you living there at that time?
What a Poughkeepsie Killer. Or should I say, which one? Which one? I'm telling you, we have the most bizarre crimes. And it's fortunate for me because I'm able to use those as fodder for my stories. The next book that I'm writing is based upon a serial killer who lived in Poughkeepsie, and he was responsible for the mysterious disappearance of eight prostitutes from 1996 to 1998. And I mean, then we had this guy whose wife disappeared and he became a hoarder. And then when he died, they were doing renovations on the house and they opened up the wall. They found that she was buried inside. I mean, again, you cannot make this stuff up. It's just really incredible. It must be something in the Hudson River. I have no idea. But it's great. I've got like a huge thick folder on all these incredible crimes that hopefully will find their ways into my book.
And you're also a watercolor artist and photographer, which I guess kind of lightens your mood a little when you're surrounded by writing all about crime. Would you say ideas come to you visually first?
You know, actually, yeah, it's more like cinema than painting. You know, it's more like a movie that goes on in my head. I think a lot of writers are like that. They visualize it in their head and then they try to transcribe it basically onto the page. How about you? Do you do that?
Yes. I find painting characters is a great way to get a little deeper into their personality. And I also work with my dreams. Sometimes I'll go to sleep and right before I nod off, I'll think, okay, how can I figure out this little piece in the plot that's not working for me yet? And I'll dream, and something in that dream helps me work out the plot. So I either paint it or get up straight away and write about it. But I use acrylic. I'm hopeless at watercolor. I have a sister who's an excellent watercolor artist, but it is difficult.
You know, it is hard. I started when I was in high school and I did it. I painted probably through college. And then when I had kids, I put it down for a while. It's just been like the past 10 years that I picked it up again. And it's an unforgiving mistress, you know, because basically you're going from, I would have to say light to dark. And once you put that stroke, that swatch on the paper, forget it. It's you're married to it. It is difficult.
It sure is. Are you currently working on another novel?
I am. It's tentatively called Hooker Avenue. And as I mentioned, it's about Jesse returns. And we also are introduced to a bunch of new characters, one being Detective Ebony Jones, who is a childhood friend of Jesse's. And they embark on actual mystery, where The Midnight Call was more like a why done it. It was more like a psychological study as to why this killer killed. This is more of a who done it. You know, first of all, they don't believe that there's a crime. There are a lot of people who don't believe that these women have disappeared. And once they find that they've disappeared, they have to try to find out who's responsible for the crime. So it's a lot of fun. I've had a lot of fun writing this.
And where are you within the manuscript?
The first draft is completed. In fact, the first draft was completed before publication of The Midnight Call, but I've been polishing it and changing things around. I've been working with a wonderful freelance editor named Jess Taylor, and he and I have been kind of toying with different ways the characters have reacted and points of view. So it's a lot of fun. I'm hoping that I'll be done with it soon and be able to submit it for publication.
Well, keep me posted when it's ready for publication. Jody, is there one book you'd like to see more people reading?
Well, yes. I am totally entrenched in the Outlander universe. I'm not sure you know about the Outlander universe, but I am, you know, I pray at the temple of Diana Gabaldon. I can tell you that. She's a wonderful writer. She's really captured my imagination. And I mean, the whole Outlander series is something. And I started reading it even before the Stars series came out. But she has 8 or 9 of them. And there's going to be one in 2021. But it's, you know, the Outlander is a wonderful series. Absolutely, absolutely spectacular. Great character studies.
And have you ever met her?
I've had the opportunity to meet her on a couple of occasions, and she is really one of the, she's brilliant. She has like two or three PhDs. I mean, she's a woman who writes everything, researches everything herself. And, you know, she's really captured the imagination of a lot of people.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So that's one book that I do recommend.
Jody, thank you so much for taking the time to come and chat with me. It's been a lot of fun. We've had a lot of giggles. And I really appreciate it and wish you all the best with your next book.
Well, you know, being a writer is, as we all know, is a very isolated way to work. So it's really nice that, you know, you, Mandy, are providing the opportunity for me to speak to another writer. You know, it's wonderful. I'm really enjoying this. And I have to thank you for that opportunity. And a fellow podcaster.
Yeah, it's nice to come out of the cave and actually have a conversation with other writers, isn't it? Now, how can people find you online?
They can go to my website, which is jodysusanmilman.com, which is J-O-D-E-S-U-S-A-N, Milman, M-I-L-L-M-A-N.com. They can follow me on Facebook at Jody Susan Milman, Instagram, Jody Milman Author, Goodreads. I'm on Goodreads, LinkedIn. I'm everywhere. Just Google me and I'm there. And, you know, I love to hear from people. I really do. And I always write back. So it's really nice to hear from readers.
Well, thanks again for being here, Jody, and you take care.
Thank you too, Mandy.
And thank you for listening. Remember, buy local, read global, support your local indie bookshop. I'll see you around the corner. For updates about the show, make sure to follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Mandy Jackson Beverly.